studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek.
And I'm Katie Mullally. And this morning, the International Commission on Geoheritage just named three geologic sites in Utah as part of the second 100 IUGS geological heritage sites. Whew. Joining us to talk about the three Utah sites and what exactly is a geoheritage site and its importance is University of Utah Geology and Geophysics Research Professor Marie Jackson.
And then in the second half of the hour, we'll speak with National Geographic Explorer and geothermal scientist Andres Russo, who speaks at Park City Institute's Eccles Center tomorrow, Friday, October 4th, as part of their popular series with National Geographic Explorers. Now, Andres Russo is truly not to be missed. He can get you more excited about geothermal science and something called ethnovolcanology than more excited, really, than you'll be about something like, I don't know, a good powder day or even Christmas. And I'm not even kidding. Also find out what he has to do with Legos. So stay tuned for that conversation. You're listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware-Peek.
Well, the International Commission on Geoheritage just named three geologic sites in Utah as part of the second 100 IUGS geological heritage sites. Like us, you're probably asking yourself, what is a geoheritage site? Well, here to tell us about the three Utah sites and what exactly is a geoheritage site and its importance is University of Utah Geology and Geophysics Research Professor Marie Jackson. Marie was part of the team that nominated the Utah sites and compiled descriptions for the IUGS Geoheritage Catalog. Whew. Marie, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Oh, good to be here.
Well, let's start off with, what is a geoheritage site? I had never heard of this before until the press release came out.
Well, this is a really important contribution to understanding geologic processes on Earth. These are the world's best demonstrations of geologic features and processes. And as the IUGS states, they are the sites of fabulous discoveries of the Earth and its history. They are sites that served to develop the science of geology. We have three of them just recently nominated here in Utah, and two of them in particular are sites of great geologic importance and discovery during the 1800s.
Well, let's start. Okay, well, what are the three sites that you and your team nominated?
Well, Margie Chan nominated Great Salt Lake and the Coyote Buttes Navajo sandstone structures, and I and David Pollard nominated the Henry Mountains.
Wow. Okay, so when I think about the Henry Mountains, Coyote Buttes, and the Great Salt Lake, they're very different in terms of geology. So you've got a lake, so the geology is mostly under the lake bed, right? Or the lake bed. And then the Coyote Buttes, the Navajo sandstone, which we all know and love, you know, are national parks for the red rocks and something that you would think is more typical of Utah. And then the Henry Mountains, which is also in southern Utah, but not the same sort of geologic formation or anything like that, like the Navajo sandstone. And I know that you spent a lot of time in the Henry Mountains. So first of all, let's kick off by talking about the Henry Mountains. Beautiful mountain range. Mm-hmm. I understand it was the last mountain range to be discovered in Utah.
Well, the Henry Mountains are the last mountain range to be discovered in the continental United States.
Oh.
They were observed first in 1871 by John Wesley Powell, during one of his trips down the Grand Canyon. And in 1875, a very astute geologist, G.K. Gilbert, came out to the Henry Mountains to make an initial survey of their structures. He rode a pack mule all the way from Salina to beyond what is Hanksville now, and returned in 1876 for a much longer field season, and wrote the first monograph of the U.S. Geological Survey, The Geology of the Henry Mountains.
So in your orbit, and I know as you had just told us before we went on air, you spent, was it 9 months in your 20s during doing your doctoral thesis mapping the Henry Mountains. So what is the thing that most blows your mind about the Henrys?
Really how beautifully they record a very important process of mountain building. When we look at the Henry Mountains from afar, we may not recognize the beauty of the arched strata over intrusions of magma, a magma called diorite. But the closer we get, especially to the southern Henry Mountains, Mount Holmes, Mount Ellsworth, and Mount Hillers, we begin to see these beautiful structures of arched strata.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are talking with research professor Marie Jackson. She is from the University of Utah Geology and Geophysics Department and was part of the team that nominated three geoheritage sites. Marie, a lot of times we'll drive down to southern Utah and you see, you know, ancient magma, volcanic rock. What caused these intrusions in the Henry Mountains way back when?
Well, let's start with G.K. Gilbert. Very early in his first trip to the Henry Mountains, he drew a structure. He made a hypothesis that magma rose up through the crust, began to flow between two layers of rock, and then eventually began to gain enough leverage as the tabular body of magma called a sill could begin to bend the overlying strata. At that point, the intrusion stopped being a sill and started becoming something he called a laccolite, which we call a laccolith now. In a sense, a cistern, that's the Greek word, a cistern of magma. And he postulated this process, visualized it, and then initiated a mechanical model to describe how these structures form.
So when he postulated this, had there been other mountain ranges or formations that had been discovered that fit the same geologic format, if you will?
Not really. In fact, there was quite a lot of discussion at the time as to whether these were lavas or magmas. And indeed, he showed that these were magmas that deformed the host rocks. And a large part of my PhD thesis was describing how the very large domes initiated and grew over time.
What's the difference between lavas and magmas? I'm picturing, when you said that, I immediately went to, I think I believed they were a bit synonymous. Obviously, I was not a geology major in college.
It's actually a rather simple description. Molten rock in the earth is called magma. When this effusive eruption of molten rock is on the surface, it's called lava.
Oh, okay. I think maybe I did know that. I love it. Okay, so the Henry Mountains are they between, I know they're south of Hanksville and north of Salina?
They're south of Hanksville. north of Lake Powell.
Right. Okay.
In fact, I think there's quite a bit of road traffic going through the Henry Mountains on the way to Lake Powell. And what we are hoping that this GeoHeritage Site designation will do is to encourage people to get out of their cars and take a look at the beauty of these structures. When G.K. Gilbert was writing his field notes, he called them the Bubble Mountains. Hmm. And he was envisioning them as bubbles of magma that arched strata into domes that actually deflected the Earth's surface. So this is an opportunity to catch snapshots in time of a mountain being built.
Wow. Well, we were talking beforehand that a lot of us, with the exception of you, Marie, have driven by the Henry Mountains, have looked over to the Henry Mountains and go, oh, I need to go by there, but you just keep going to wherever it is you're going. And late last month, the BLM released a new travel management plan for the Henry Mountains. Tell us about that, because that maybe that's going to be a guide to get us all, if, like you said, out of our cars and into the Henrys.
Well, I think we need to be careful with that. The plan was released on September 25th, and we have until October 26th to make comments on this. There's an announcement out through the BLM Richfield office, and we really want to make sure that these mountains and the beautiful pediment structures of transported rocks along their flanks remain intact. This is the world's best example of this mountain building process. There should be really no off-road vehicle activity at all within the domes. These are strata that have been tilted from 20 degrees at slope at Mount Holmes to 55 degrees at Mount Ellsworth to 85 degrees, nearly vertical at Mount Hillers. So they're very delicate. We certainly don't want to be disturbing those beautiful flexed strata or the long sloping pediments that come off the mountains, which actually record quite a bit of landslide and slump activity.
Well, and I think one thing that's important to remember, even I need to remember this when I'm out, you know, driving around and I study geology, is that when you formations are laid flat, and when you see strata that are tilted, that means some mechanical earthly force actually moved them. And the Henry Mountains are such a great example of the Earth's power to move rock and shape mountains. What is it like when you get to the Henry Mountains and you're standing on top of one of them? What do you actually, can you see all of these different formations?
You're absolutely right. In these big mountains, the first mechanical process was one of bending, somewhat like bending a telephone book, for example, with a lower hinge, a central limb, and then a curving upper hinge. And Gilbert described that in detail. We can see the beautiful colored strata from Permian to, Cretaceous in age, tilted around the bases of the large domes. It's very stunning to walk in there and see sedimentary rock turned up on end in these beautiful flexures.
Mm. Beautiful. Is the mechanical lifting, forming, what makes the Henry Mountains so high? I mean, I know that there it's close to the highest peak in the Wasatch Mountain, Nebo, at, I think Mount Nebo is 11,900 or something, and the tallest peak in the Henrys is right around 11,000.
Mm-hmm, that's Mount Ellen, 11,522. My work has focused on the three southern Henry Mountains. Mount Holmes is about 8,000 feet, and it has uplifted the strata 1.2 kilometers. That's how big the laccolith displacement was. But even more fascinating is at Mount Ellsworth, we get another snapshot in the process. The same size laccolith mountain is about 8,200 feet, and that strata has been uplifted 1.8 kilometers. At Mount Hillers, about 10,700 feet, the strata has been lifted 2.5 kilometers. So
wow.
We're looking at hugely massive displacements of rock that begins by bending and then ends up by stretching and other kinds of deformation.
Wow. Well, it's fun to see how excited you are to talk about the Henry Mountains. But since there are two other geoheritage sites that have been recently announced, Coyote Buttes and Great Salt Lake, it makes me wonder why something like Great Salt Lake hadn't been named to the list decades ago, especially when, well, it's my question, does being named a geoheritage site afford that site more protection? Because we sure could have used some more protection for Great Salt Lake a long, long time ago before it came into such peril.
That's true. And in speaking with Margie Chan, who nominated Great Salt Lake, it was a little bit challenging because Great Salt Lake, which G.K. Gilbert also described those processes in the 1880s, has so much construction and disruption around it that she had to go to Antelope Island to be able to describe real structures that fit with the geoheritage site recommendations.
For the few of our listeners who have not been down to Coyote Buttes, it's in the Wave area just south of Kanab, and it's such a striking formation and so different. And yes, it is the Navajo sandstone, but it's such a crisscross, an amalgamation of different layers of Navajo sandstone. How did that form, and what makes it so unique in terms of the sandstone structures and displays that we see down in southern Utah?
Well, the Coyote Buttes and the Wave are Jurassic in age. The Navajo sandstone is actually one of the beds that was uplifted over the Henry Mountains. So we see it in a very different context in the Coyote Buttes. It's exposed very differently. And this is a deposit that records enormous dunes of windblown sand that form lamina on downfall surfaces and then are suddenly destroyed by big, long, flat structures, reworked again and again and again. When I see that kind of structure, I'm aware that somehow a giant dune has been frozen in time. That actually records the enormous force of blowing sand, like 200 million years ago. It's another snapshot in time of a very dynamic process.
And it's such a dynamic state. So going forward, do you see any other sites in Utah that could be proposed for the geoheritage site? Because we are such a diverse state geologically.
I think we have so much beautiful exposure of rock in Utah. Somewhere else, for example, on the East Coast, we might not have been able to see very much of these kinds of structures if they had existed. But we have so much raw rock here, and I don't have specific suggestions at present, but I know that the rock that G.K. Gilbert viewed in the 1870s and 80s is still here for the most part, and we need to be taking care of it so other generations can see it in its beauty and intelligence as well.
So, as Katie said, she had never heard of geoheritage sites prior to getting the press release from the University of Utah, nor had I. I know some of the protections that are afforded or designated for areas that become wilderness, that get a wilderness designation. And I don't know at all what kind of protection, you know, once you have the designation of a geoheritage site, what does that mean in perpetuity in terms of protection?
Well, this is a fairly new program within IUGS. I think one of the strategies is to recognize these features and use that as a seed to further grow protection around them, especially for places like the Henry Mountains that don't have, like, for example, a national park status. Mm-hmm. So I think this is a tool we can use as we work to recognize these very precious places on Earth, even, you know, as such a grassroots response as a comment to the BLM travel management mm-hmm. program.
As we hear more and more about the percentage of Utah land that is BLM land and people hungry to take away the designation and claim more of that land for whatever it might be, from extraction to housing to some of the things. These geoheritage sites, I'm still not clear if it does protect them at all, or is it just a precursor to the possible protection by some other means like wilderness designation or national park status?
You're right. It's a precursor. When we look at a place like the Henry Mountains that has very little economic value in terms of mineral deposits, as we make the geology of the system more available to the public, we learn that most of the beautiful slopes of the mountains are old landslide scarps or slumps. They have slope stability problems, and the domes themselves are unstable. Those are reasons not to build.
Yeah.
Well, our guest today has been Marie Jackson. She is a research professor of geology and geophysics at the University of Utah and part of the team that nominated three sites from Utah for the IUGS Geological Heritage Sites. Well, Marie, I think it's important for all of us to go out and appreciate these sites, because even though this may be just a precursor, it still shows the importance of what these sites mean for geology, for science, and just for the history of the state. We will have links to the press release and to the International Commission on Geoheritage on our website. Marie, thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Marie. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Well, tomorrow, Friday, October 4th, at Park City Institute's Eccles Theater here in Park City, you can be enchanted by hearing about the adventures and discoveries of a geothermal scientist. A geothermal scientist? Really? Yes, really. Follow geothermal scientist Andres Rousseau for a journey to far-off lava fields, hidden boiling rivers, and through the fiery portals to the Earth's core. Andres can talk about these things in a way that will make you want to go back to school and become a geothermal scientist. He joins us now to preview what he'll talk about tomorrow. Andres Rousseau, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Buenos dias. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you, guys. What a great introduction. Thank you.
Well, we're really excited to have you and to have you coming to town. And this is a series that is backed by popular demand at the Eccles Center. And what it shows about the population here in Park City, Summit County, Wasatch County, is that we're very curious people. And we want to know what makes people like you tick. So let's start off with, what got you into this field that you're in?
I mean, boiling it down, quite, no pun intended, I guess, but boiling it down, I love being outside. Ever since I was a kid, I was fascinated with nature. I personally grew up between Peru, Nicaragua, and the United States. And, you know, bits, when you're a third culture kid, kind of confused about where you're from, you know, for me, nature was very much one of the, a constant. And it was something that, you know, I found solace in, I found wonder in, I found fascination in. And truly, it's just so inspiring. So I want to share that with others. I want people to fall in love with nature, and that's the goal at the end of the day.
Also, for people to fall in love with the idea that there are still many things to discover out there. You discovered the Boiling River in Peru. You'll have to tell me how that's pronounced in the native language.
Absolutely. So in all fairness, that's two points, right? I technically do hold the term scientific discoverer, but I do want to make super clear that, I mean, I made friends with the locals and the locals gave me the tour. They knew about this place forever. And they are my very close collaborators on this and working with different Amazonian communities down there. But absolutely, the Xanai Timpishka, Xanai, well, literally means heat of the sun. Timpu is the verb to boil. So boiled with the heat of the sun, such a cool name. The Xanai Timpishka, or Boiling River of the Amazon, is up until now still the largest documented thermal river on the planet. We're looking at almost 4 miles of thermal flow, much of that hot enough to kill you. And hottest temperature I measured got up to about 210 degrees Fahrenheit, and about 117, you and I start to cook. So it is an amazing ecosystem, a window into so many things as far as everything from potentially life in the deep subsurface to geothermal processes in non-volcanic areas to so much more. Just a fascinating place. I sincerely hope that everyone gets to go down and visit the Amazon one day. That would be a dream of mine.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are talking with Nat Geo Explorer, geothermal scientist, Andres Ruzzo, and he is speaking at the Eccles Theater tomorrow, October 4th. Well, Andres, before we started talking, we were admiring the rock collection on your wall, and you brought up a fascinating term that I'd never heard before called ethnovolcanology. And I think as we think about, you know, archaeology, we look at climate and we look at topography and we look at biology, but never really thought about looking at the geology, how and how it ties to archaeology. So I know this is a big part of your talk tomorrow, and I find it fascinating. Tell us about ethnovolcanology.
Oh, I am so excited about this because it's, you know, for me, I am fascinated by Earth's heat. I'm fascinated by geothermal systems in particular. So if you look at your daily routine. And this is one of my favorite things to talk about because I have students, right? And yeah, I have collaborators. Most likely, you know, you go about your day and then you go take a shower. Maybe you take a hot bath, for example. The fact that you're even creating an artificial quote unquote geothermal system in your home, potentially on a daily basis, I think is pretty cool. You look at every single culture, every single place I've ever been to on Earth, every single culture from every single time, where there's hot springs, which is really the part that I get excited about, humans have had some special interaction with them. When there's a volcano, there's been some special significance virtually at every site I've ever seen, be it, spirits that live there or creation stories that come out of there. Or, you know, I mean, you go to Japan, for example, the onsen culture is just spectacular. What's not to love? Humans have found these things significant wherever they go. I was just in Arkansas not too long ago, Hot Springs, Arkansas, an area of peace. You know, there's a lot of stories embedded in these geothermal systems. And once you start looking at it from that perspective, you're like, wait a minute, there's more here. This has been one of the influencing factors on making humans humans at the end of the day, I would argue.
Well, we were talking about some lovely obsidian that you have on your wall. And tell us about the correlation between how they find, you know, like they'll find obsidian pieces or arrowheads from one sort of specific volcanic source. And how can that actually prove? Because I know there's been this discussion up in Yellowstone where they used to think that there weren't any indigenous tribes, but now they're finding, you know, tools, if you will, that had to have come from that area. So how is this changing the face of what we understand about archaeology?
So there's a lot of exceptional work, for example, going on at Yellowstone. I'm glad you mentioned it. In fact, Dr. Jeff Hungerford, the head geologist from Yellowstone, is one of the best human beings I've ever gotten to work with. Anyone that gets a chance to go to Yellowstone, go. And so last time I was there, I actually got to see some of the lava flows that were there. So anywhere on Earth. You know, I've worked mainly in Latin America. That's my heart and soul. I'm Peruvian. But wherever you have these resources, I mean, the fact that, you know, a lot of times people say, oh, well, during the conquest, the Spaniards had their guns, germs, and steel, right? The steel bit. If you have rocks where you can literally pop off knives, and I've seen people do it from a they call it a core and nucleo, right, of obsidian. You can pop out a knife very fast. And these are sharper than surgical steel. And you get someone who really knows how to do it. I mean, it is absolutely amazing, the precision, the quickness, and then the durability of those obsidian knives. If you have that at the ready, that is one heck of a resource. So definitely you've got the sheep eater tribe, for example, at Yellowstone was taking advantage of that. Later tribes that would come in and out of it would also look at obsidian cliffs to use that for resources. And, you know, back here, for example, I do have Mexico, there's a place called Pachuca that created a greenish obsidian. So it had a bit of a green hue to it, green in a lot of rocks globally. You can go to the Maori in New Zealand, the jade in China and Southeast Asia, in Mesoamerica. It's often, you know, green stones in particular, given this life, right? The green is the color of life. So they suddenly take on ceremonial meaning. So something like this was often used as a dagger. I'm showing one of these green obsidians. But another one, for example, you know, if you humans wear jewelry, here's another obsidian. This is one of my favorite pieces. When I turn it around, you'll really see it. So if you get the light right, this, which should be normal black obsidian, flashes bright gold. Gold obsidian, rainbow obsidian, like this one that I'm showing you here. You get the angle right and it should flash. I see it right there. Do you guys see it? It's flashing rainbow. I mean, this is beautiful. We decorate our homes with this. In fact, when you start thinking about it, actually, my son lost my wedding ring, so now I've got a backup for now. But before, right, it was made of metal. It was a white gold ring. A lot of our minerals, a lot of our precious stones, they come from geothermal systems. So there's a very good chance you're actually wearing a piece of geothermal geology on you right now.
I love it. So we're speaking with Andres Russo. He'll be at the Eccles Center here in Park City tomorrow night as part of Park City Institute or Park City Performing Arts lineup of National Geographic Explorers. And our listeners cannot see what we're seeing now. We're on a Zoom call with you, and we are seeing this collection that you've got in your room there. And you're the excitement with which you go about explaining each little exhibit you have in that room is palpable. It's really contagious. And it makes me think about if young people come and listen to you talk, I remember when my kids were little, you know, going down to Southern Utah and just looking through the rock collections and trying to find crystals. Kids eat this stuff up, and it really makes them excited. So can you talk a little bit about your audiences and, you know, who your talk most appeals to?
You know, it's meant to be a general audience, but definitely I'm an educator and I work with kids. In fact, I'm a big fan of getting kids out in the field. So I love that you took your kids to Southern Utah. Also, I got to say, Utah is one of the prettiest states in the United States. There is so much. That's the one place I definitely would love to get lost in. In fact, I was really lucky and got to do work at the University of Utah for a couple of years. You know, I would fly in and out, but what a great spot. You know, so definitely a general audience for sure. I love working with kids. I take students down into the Amazon. We have since 2016. Anyone who wants to come, anyone who has a spark, a passion, excitement about a curiosity about our world, I definitely invite to come see this. All audiences are welcome.
Okay, I'm a kid at heart. Katie's a kid at heart. Can we go to the Amazon with you?
Please. This sounds funny, but I swear, I head up an Amazonian conservation project. I just got out of the Amazon again last week. I definitely strongly believe the very best thing you can do for the Amazon is go visit. When you go visit, you change people's minds and you change people's hearts first and foremost. And then also you invest in what you believe is worthwhile. And then also you have an amazing experience as well. So come visit.
Well, let's switch to more of a global perspective, because, you know, like we look at, you know, Yellowstone and other specific geothermal places, and as climate change happens, the water levels change and we see roads melting, specifically Yellowstone, or these explosions that they have. But tell us about the global implications of changing geothermal systems. It doesn't just affect the park 400 miles to the north of us.
So there's a lot there. For geothermal systems, it depends on the type of system, and we can get really technical really fast with this. So I'm going to back up a little bit and say different systems have different sources. Sometimes you have a short cycle geothermal system, if you will, where, you know, rainwater will come down, heat up locally, and, you know, change. And that's where, to your question, in light of climate change, if you're changing weather patterns, those short-term systems will get impacted first. Or in the Amazon right now. So the boiling river of the Amazon, for example, is a longer-term system. Actually, the research of the University of Utah helped us figure that out. So, but in light of that, though, what we're dealing with right now is the drivers. Right now, we are dealing with some of the worst, actually the single worst forest fires we have ever seen in all of human history in Amazonia. I mean, my backpack still smells like smoke, cleaned it like four times. And anyway, it's a problem, because actually this is what a lot of my research deals with. So what's incredible about geoscience is, especially if, like, I'm using a stable isotope specifically is what a lot of the work I'm doing, and looking at the families of elements within water, within the H's, within the O's, to figure out, you know, what's that story? Because every drop of water has a fingerprint. Here's some water from the boiling river, for example. And every drop of water has a fingerprint. That fingerprint tells you something about its origins. Well, what we're seeing in the Amazon is about 80% of the rainfall that falls to Earth during the dry season comes from the jungle itself. So every tree you chop down takes away a little bit of water from the next dry season rains that are so critical to keep the Amazon, an area 90% the size of the United States, the world's largest remaining intact forest, and an area that's given us so many medicines. I mean, if you like chocolate, you better thank the Amazon. If you like drinking coffee, even though it's not native, a lot of the sustainably grown coffee also comes from the Amazon. So if you want to fight for chocolate and coffee, I would suggest, you know, caring about the Amazon. But you can see that in the geoscience, and that's how that's one of the ways that water cycle is absolutely critical.
Well, one of the things that's been so fascinating from what I've been reading about the Boiling River is that a lot of geothermal rivers that, you know, that create their own heat are near volcanic centers, especially, you know, referencing back to Yellowstone. But the Boiling River is, what, 700 miles from any sort of volcanic activity? So where is that? What is the source of that geothermal activity?
Well, it is over 700 kilometers or over 430 miles-ish away from the nearest active volcanic center. But I'm going to tell you the rest of the story tomorrow, because it's a really fascinating story of what makes the Boiling River boil, what makes a Boiling River tick, if you will. And that's what we're going to share tomorrow. How about that?
that works. Our listeners will have to go tomorrow to, like you said, hear the rest of the story on that one. Another thing I was reading about you is that you work with Lego. So are you the official volcano Lego designer? And how do you design a volcanic shaped magma shaped Lego?
Oh man. So I am not a Lego designer as much as I would love to be, but I was the partnership ambassador for the Nat Geo Lego partnership. So that was one of the most fun projects I ever did. Lego was unveiling Lego City Volcano. Later on, they also did Lego City Jungle, and I also was the Nat Geo Lego partnership ambassador for that. And we got to go with Lego to the Amazon, to the Boiling River, to do a bunch of really cool stuff, cool filming, lots of fun stuff. But yeah, with this product line that Lego came out with, it really celebrated volcanology. There was a bit of sci-fi in there too, which was fun. But oh man, it was cool. It was really cool.
That really gives Lego a lot of credibility that they actually go to these professionals to get be consulted on how they might go about designing there.
I keep looking this way. I'm gonna it's here. I gotta pull this one out. Sorry, I exited stage and left real quick. But like, I mean, they did a good job. I hope you can see that little Lego guy there. But you know, the rock hammer. There's even a geode there. A little crystal. You know, it's just so fun. And getting, especially like, I've got a 6-year-old son, getting the chance to, you know, here's my thing. I think that if there's a way to make virtually anything simple enough for a quote unquote child to understand.
Yeah.
And so much of that is play. Again, I'm an educator at heart here. And if you look at who we are as humans, we're mammals. And how do mammals learn? Mammals learn best by playing. We know that. There's no question. That's why, you know, younger kids tend to be so rough on our furniture or our gear because they're testing everything out. You give, and this is what I love about this Lego set, you know, you give people a chance to play, to familiarize themselves with something they wouldn't normally see. And there's not only an emotional connection that's drawn, but also, you know, an invitation to explore. And that invitation to explore, I think, is what I valued most about Lego City Volcano and the Lego City Jungle. And also, actually with Lego City Jungle, if I could throw in one more thing there, one of the fun things about that Lego set campaign too was, so we had, you know, all these cool jungle sets that came out of there, but we also had this educational competition that came out of it. And the idea was, you know, kids have their Lego. Most kids these days do have a phone or something to take pictures with. And the idea was that, you know, you go outside, you set up your Lego, you tell an educational story, and you submit that. And the winner got to have an all-expenses-paid trip for four on a Nat Geo expedition to the jungles of Costa Rica. And it was a little girl from Poland who won. It's fun. I mean, if we truly care about the future, if we truly care about all the things that we adults love to talk about, we have to invite kids to be a part of it. They are the future. Where we can talk about it, they will live it. And that's, again, one of the reasons I'm so fired up about what I do.
Yeah, you are so fired up. And you know, it's interesting now that you have a 6-year-old son, because you got interested in this as a kid. I knew that you had heard of the Boiling River when you were a kid. I think it was a story told to you by your grandfather. Is that right?
That's absolutely right.
That's what got you excited about it and made you want to explore to the extent that you became, okay, the scientific discoverer of the Boiling River in Peru. But will you talk a little bit about that, about how you got excited from just these tales and this, maybe what some people would think of as folklore passed down through the generations?
Oh, you just touched on two things that got me even more excited. And I'm an excitable person, as you can probably tell. You know, we often forget science is rooted in observation. And I work with a lot of traditional knowledge holders, shamans, curanderos, I mean, you name it, right? Traditional leaders. And time after time, one of the things that I've come to value most is, you know, the observations are the same. The interpretations might be very different, but the observations are rooted in something amazing. Just to give you a quick example, right? There's an example I'm going to talk about the show, so I can't talk about that right now. But you know, we were in the jungle with some entomologists, right? And they caught a mantis, and we're there with a friend of ours. She's a Shipibo Kanibo shamaness, and she's like, "Oh, you guys are studying mantises," to the entomologist, right? And she's like, "How interesting. You know, those are our pregnancy tests, right?" And we're like, "Wait, what?" And she's like, "Yeah, well, traditionally, you know, you'd have a pregnant lady and she'd put a mantis on top of her belly. And if the mantis took this position, holding out its arms, it was going to be, it's going to be a little girl. And if the mantis takes this position, you know, it's pointing out like a lance, then it's going to be a little boy." And you know, a beautiful cultural story with a solid observation, because then suddenly the entomologists, also Nat Geo explorers, they, you know, pop up. They're like, "Oh my gosh, those defensive postures weren't documented in the scientific literature until, you know, a couple decades ago. This has been observed forever. So a lot of our histories, a lot of our stories, humans have sought to explain sometimes the quote unquote unexplainable. That's what so many of our stories, our legends, our myths are rooted in. There are some very fascinating observations. Again, the interpretation for a scientific interpretation versus legendary or traditional interpretation could be very, very different, but that observation is key. And when you go back to the observation level, you go back to the experiential level. And when you go to the experiential level, that's where individually we connect with our landscapes. And that's part of the fun.
Well, let's talk more about indigenous knowledge, because I know that's one of the things that you just talked about, like with the praying mantis. Mm-hmm. How, you know, every acre, every foot of Amazon rainforest that's cut down, we lose more of that knowledge. How are you working with these Amazon tribes to, is there a way to preserve this knowledge?
You know, absolutely. So this is, number one part of it is bringing value to it. And it's not, what I've learned is it's not just the Amazon, but it's globally. I mean, we have, there is so much that is being lost. And that what I'm going to, a lot of what I'm going to talk about tomorrow is in the face of a volcano, a big, potentially scary volcano, understanding it scientifically and understanding what the risks are is one thing. Understanding how to best live with it as an individual, as a human, potentially as a non-expert, understanding how to live with it is another. And I would argue, and I'm going to make this argument tomorrow, that both how to understand it properly and how to live with it as a human, both things, well, one tends to be more in the realm of traditional knowledge, one tends to be more in the realm of scientific knowledge. I really do. I mean, and when they come together, we get a deeper perspective. So that's the thing. We see the world better with both eyes is what I'm going to be saying. And in this case, yes, we do lose a lot of the, so in the Amazon, we are losing about 2 soccer fields of Amazon rainforest every single minute. And that's been true for, unfortunately, most of my life. But beyond that, cultural erosion as well, cultural degradation because of globalization, because of a whole host of issues, is a major problem. So one of my great mentors, unfortunately, he passed with COVID 2 years ago. He was the leader of a Shipibo tribe, one of the communities. And he would always say, you know, Andres, you need to remember that the biggest threat to the Amazon is like our people, you know, our role should be as the guardians of the forest. But in his own words, the biggest threat to the Amazon are the natives that have forgotten that they're natives. And that's why he said, Andres, the most important thing that any of us can do right now, education, revalue our cultures, because it's one thing to know in your head, right, that tree is worth a lot of money, that animal I can shoot like this, but it's equally important to, in your heart, he would say in his own words, right, what's the dignity of this? Where do I draw that line? Where do I say that's enough? I've taken too much. And he would always say, if you don't have both of those things in balance, you're in trouble. So that's why he pushed very much to start a Shipibo school, to bring value to the culture. And that's what we're trying to do. So in everything that I'm doing with my researchers, with my colleagues, with my, you know, Western scientific team, right? In every step of the way, we are collaborating with our indigenous colleagues, with our experts in traditional knowledge, to show that the world is richer when you see the world with both eyes, that the world is richer when we learn from each other, and that neither of us can do this alone. Because there is a fire that the traditional knowledge systems tend to spark within people. I don't know what it is, but maybe it's written deep in our DNA. It touches a chord with most people. But at the same time, there is a clarity and a beauty and an elegance to the scientific method that shows you the finer details of our beautiful world that you might miss otherwise. So when you bring those two together, I mean, it's just a symphony. So that's what we hope to do.
Wow. Well, Andres Russo, thank you so much for joining us on Full Science Radio. This has been so much fun. And I hope that every one of our listeners will come and see you tomorrow night at the Eccles Center here in Park City. What an opportunity. Andres Russo is a geothermal scientist. He's an ethnovolcanologist. I bet no one's heard of that before. And he is a National Geographic Explorer, and he'll be joining us tomorrow right here in Park City. Thank you again for joining us this morning. This has been wonderful.
Oh, you're both so great. Thank you so much. I hope we get to see each other in person. And if not, come to the Amazon.
Come to the Amazon. It's that simple. But I'll tell you what, if I could go to the Amazon with Andres Russo, Katie, I mean, we'd do it, right?
Oh, in a second.
We talk to a lot of scientists on this show, and I don't think that we have spoken to someone so that can get you so excited about the science that they practice. It was amazing.
Every question we asked him, the energy and the way his eyes lit up, he was thrilled to answer anything we asked. And then to see the little Lego man that I'm going to say was based on him.
Yeah.
I mean, what an honor.
Absolutely. So he is coming to speak again at Park City's Eccles Center, part of Park City Institute or Park City Performing Arts series. It's a National Geographic Explorer series. Tomorrow night he's coming, Friday. So go to parkcityinstitute.org to get your tickets to see Andres Russo. You will think it's the most exciting thing that you've done on a Friday night in a long time. I'm going to say, I promise.
Yeah, I'm going to be there. Looking forward to it.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. As always, you can find our archive shows, or say you didn't get to hear all of the interview, go back to kpcw.org or find us wherever you get your podcasts. We're KPCW Cool Science Radio. You can go on the NPR One app to find us, or just about anywhere else. So take us with you on a car ride.
And then next week, we've got a couple of fascinating interviews. One is going to be with Mark Weinstein, and he wrote a book, and he's talking about what exactly are bots and trolls on the internet and how we can better protect ourselves and avoid these, let's just say, mishaps, if you will.
Yeah, really fascinating, and a lot of things that we had never heard about, right? How to protect your privacy, just mm-hmm. some really basic, very basic things, so really interesting. And then we'll be speaking with Jules Howard, and he is a zoological correspondent, and he writes about the evolution of the egg and how it's a metaphor for the evolution of the earth. It's so interesting to hear these stories about the egg, simple egg, whether it's a bird or an insect or a mammal or whatever it is. So thanks for tuning in.